The aim is really to the triumph of renormalization and to show you how this procedure can give you some, you know, interesting information about physical systems. So namely, you know, how it gives you better critical exponents than the mean field theory does. But before I actually go to that, let me just, you know, really repeat what we have done so far. So the renormalization is really, you know, to split your calculation of the partition function, which is an integration over slow and fast modes, into the integration over only the slow modes by doing the integration over fast ones explicitly. And in that case, your action S gets modified to some S tilde, which is now dependent only on these slow modes. So now we can basically split this procedure into three steps. So step A will be to find what this S tilde phi slow explicitly is. Okay, so on one hand, we know that it must have the following form because there is nothing else I can write down, basically. Everything else will be irrelevant. And so consequently, you can have some couplings here, R0 tilde and R2 tilde and R4 tilde here. And then you have something which has two external slow legs. So you have a creature with two legs, and then moreover, they are slow, so very strange creature. And then you have a creature with four external slow legs. And of course, then in principle, you could have with six and eight and so on, but these creatures are very rare, and they are irrelevant for what happens on the S. Okay, so it's just these two creatures. So we know definitely this. At the same time, this is an explicit form how to calculate this S tilde phi slow. And it's basically by comparing whatever you see here with whatever you see there, and that's your definition of S tilde. And so this S tilde is given to the zero order just by the non-interacting S0 just evaluated on the slow modes. Then the first correction is that you take the interacting part of your action, and you average it over the fast modes, and then the second will be S square. And so all this is called cumulant expansion. Okay, so now, of course, the first part, the zero order, is very simple. So the zero order is just what we know. So S0 phi slow. It's really just, you know, you take S0 and then you put slow there. So it's 1/2 and then k square plus r. This is what we had. And then phi slow k square. Okay, so to the zeros order, if you look at, we want to find what these r2 tilde and r0 tilde and r4 tilde are. So to the zero order, we just find that r2 tilde is equal to 1. R0 tilde is just equal to R, and you know nothing about R4 tilde. So it's equal to 0. So that's zero order, and that's simple. So now, in order to calculate the first order, we introduce this diagrammatic notation. So we have this S interacting part, and you can plot it as a diagram where I use full line for the slow modes, and then dotted line for the fast modes. And so you have all possibilities. So there's this interacting vertex here, U, and then you have four times, and then you have three full lines and one dotted one, and then you have four the other way around. So dotted, and then one is full, and then you have six times, you have two full and two dotted ones, and then finally you have all dotted ones, and there's only one possibility. Of course, these numbers, they are just combinatorial factors, which actually come from here. Okay, so that's what your S interacting is. And so now you need to find, to calculate the first order, you need to do the average over the fast modes, meaning you have to kill all the fast modes by integrating them out. Okay, so now if you want S interacting average over the fast modes, that means And then I showed you yesterday, it means basically connecting all the fast modes you can see in pairs. Okay, so here I have no fast modes, so this is as it were. So now I want to connect this fast mode here with something else, but I have nothing else which is fast. Okay, so this has to give me zero, 4 times 0, because I cannot find any fast mode to connect this. So here, yes, I can connect this guy with this one or that one, but then I have one fast mode left and I have nothing to connect it with it, with that. So again, it's 0, 4 times 0. So here I'm lucky, I have exactly 1 and 1. So this gives me a diagram like that. And that's the one which contributes. And here I will have a diagram like that, but it has no slow modes whatsoever. So that gives me just a number. So you integrate it over all fast modes, there are no slow modes left. So you see that this average over S integration gives something which has 4 external legs. This guy has 4 legs. And then you have one guy which has 2 legs. 2 legs. And then you have a guy which has 0 legs. Okay. So now, of course, you are interested in calculating what these R2 tilde and R0 tilde and R4 tilde are. And so for that, you have to compare, you know, the right number of legs, right? So it's obvious that this thing will give me what this R4 tilde is. And of course, you know, what it just gives you is just the S interacting and this phi, 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 phi. Slow, 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 slow. And so what you find from this diagram that this R4 tilde in this approximation is just U. Okay. Here you don't find, of course, anything. And so I showed you yesterday that this diagram is the interesting one. And it gives you 6 times U/4, and there was some integral, which was some concrete expression, and of course phi slow k². So this is when you actually calculate this diagram. And it's precisely what you expect. So it has 2 external slow legs. So it will contribute to R2 tilde or R0 tilde, but it has such an expression that it doesn't contribute actually to R2 tilde, it's only to R0 tilde. So this guy gives you a correction to what R0 tilde is. And of course, this is just a number, and you know, you are not really interested in this type of diagram. So this is how you do the first order correction. Is there any question here? Okay, so then we very briefly did also the second order. So if you go to the second order, then of course it's given by this minus one half, and then S interacting square minus S interacting the whole thing square. And so this will again be displayed by some diagrams, which will now be composed basically of composing 2 interacting parts. But what this term actually really does for you, and you can start drawing pictures for yourself, is that, you know, I can have all possible diagrams here which are connected or not. But these terms precisely cancel all those that are not connected. So in the end, this is just a sum over all connected diagrams. And so, because you are connecting S interacting, which has 4 legs, with another S interacting, which has 4 legs, I can always connect 2. So I either get, you know, with 0, 2, 4, 6, or 8 legs, in principle, after the averaging is done. So now, is that correct what I wrote down? Can you have a connected diagram of all these things?
So a barrel could have 8 legs.
Sorry?
You couldn't have 8 legs or a
Exactly. Thank you so much. So I cannot have, you know, a connected diagram with 8 legs, because that would mean, well, I cannot connect anything, right? So what's going on here? So of course the 0 legs is boring because again it gives you a number, so that's not interesting. So now if you look at, let's say, 2 legs, so what you are really doing is that you want 2 external legs. So I have to start with, let's say, this is one, my one S interacting, and then I will have another S interacting. So now this is fine. I have one and second external leg, and so now I have to connect, you know, all these fast modes to get something. And so one possibility, for example, would be that I connect these two together, these two together, and these two together. So one diagram could be something like this. Okay, so now you are of course interested in how many such diagrams you can have. Okay, so how many such diagrams you can have? So here, the number of these diagrams as the combinatorial factor. So here I'm choosing 1 out of 4 legs to be the external one, to the slow one. Okay, so that's 4. The same thing on the right hand side, I'm choosing 1 to be slow out of 4, so it's times 4. And then I'm choosing basically one of these 3 which will be connected with the other one, and one of these 3 which will be connected with the other one. So it's 3 times 3 is 9. Okay, and then there's this factor 1/2. It's from the prefactor. Okay, so it's 4 times 4 times 9 divided by 2 and should be 72. Can anybody check, is it 72? Maybe it is. Okay, yes?
Yeah, little question. You have a diagram there where there's like one soft particle coming in, right? Slow mode.
Yeah.
So it has low momentum.
Yeah.
And it transfers into high momentum.
Yeah. So this diagram is impossible. Yeah, this diagram is impossible. I agree with that. So we discussed that yesterday, that in fact you cannot satisfy conservation of momentum in this vortex because you are changing slow momentum to the fast one. So you know, I'm just, you know, trying to say what you are trying to do. So this is one possibility you could try to draw. And then you, based on the physical thing, that actually you cannot conserve momentum here. This is actually, so you know, does not contribute anyway. Does not contribute anyway, as we discussed yesterday. Okay. So another possibility, you know, connecting these two things is, let's say I connect this guy with that guy, this guy with that guy, and that guy with that guy. So then I get a diagram which looks like this thing, and then that, and that, and that, and that. Okay, so this diagram is, so what is the number of these diagrams? So again, forming this and that, I have 4 times 4. I always have to choose 1 slow out of 4 here, and 1 slow out of 4. And then I want to connect this guy with something here. And of course I have 3 possibilities. And then this guy, and now I have only 2 possibilities. So it's 3 times 2 is 6 possibilities. So times 6 times 1/2, I get it from the prefactor, and that gives you 48. So this would be, you know, how this diagram would contribute, just based, that's the combinatorial factor which stands by this diagram here. Okay, and then of course you would have to check all the momenta, all the conditions satisfied, and if they are, this diagram will contribute. But of course it's a diagram which has 2 slow external legs. So the only thing which can it contribute is to the first piece here, is 2 external slow legs. It can contribute to R2 tilde and R0 tilde. It cannot contribute to R4 tilde. So these things can contribute to R2 tilde and R0 tilde, but not this R4 tilde. Okay, so that's the diagram with two legs. And so what I was trying to tell you yesterday is that if you want, you know, some first correction to you, well, of course, we need to go to the diagrams with four legs. So four legs, that means I will, for example, connect as interacting, which has two fast and two slow. And so if you connect these things here, for example, this guy is that guy, and this guy is that guy, you get a diagram which looks like this, which is precisely the diagram which is actually interesting here. So again, you are interested in the combinatorial factor of this diagram. So how many numbers is here? So now for this guy, you need to choose two out of four, which will be the slow modes, and you know, should be. So you have now 4/2, which is six possibilities. The same thing for the right hand side, for the right diagram. So it's again 6 times 6. And so then I have a possibility I want to connect this guy with this guy or with that guy. So it's two possibilities. And then there's this p-factor 1/2. So we have 36 of these diagrams. And they will contribute to your U. And I calculated yesterday that the contribution of this diagram gives you 36 times U/4 square, because you have two vertices. And then there was some new integral I, which we approximated by some magic. And then, of course, you have k1 to k4, phi slow. So this gives you really a contribution to R4 tilde. So it gives you what R4 tilde, how it gets modified. And then you can keep going. You can go to six legs. And so, for example, if you had six legs, so these four legs contribute to R4 tilde. And then you can go six legs. Of course, you are not interested in them because they are irrelevant creatures with that many legs on the earth are irrelevant. But you know, you could, for example, plot a diagram which would have something like this, and then you have three here, and then one fast, and you would connect these things. And that would be the corresponding diagram which would represent your six legs diagram, but it's not interesting here. So in fact, you can show that really it's only this diagram which contributes to two legs, and it's only this diagram which contributes to four legs. Okay, so now, questions? So this is how the combinatorial factors are calculated and what you need to do and so on. Okay, so that was step A. So really to get what this, how these R2 tilde and R0 tilde and R4 tilde really look like. So then step B was to bring S tilde slow to original form. And so while doing that, you realize that the only thing that changes is the couplings. So you go from RU to R tilde U tilde. And so I try to argue very briefly that in the end, so this gives you some recursion between RU and R tilde U tilde. And in the end, you are interested, if you repeat that many times, you're interested in fixed point. And that's what we'll study today. And then you have those prescriptions. So first of all, we changed, well, of this R2 tilde, we define it to be B to eta R tilde plus B 2 minus eta R0 tilde, and then U tilde is B to 4 minus 2 eta minus D R4 tilde. So this really, this prescription by, you know, going, putting it into the original form, we could relate these quantities which are calculated by this diagrammatic notation to whatever we need to know about how these couplings change under the normalization group form. Okay, and by the way, there was this change of k and x as well. So at the same time, we were doing that k tilde was k times b. So that was the transformation of k, which means that x tilde is just x divided by b. And also, we had to renormalize the field. And so the renormalization was that phi tilde was something like b to minus t plus 2 minus eta over 2 phi slow. So this is what we needed to do in order to bring the action into the original form. Okay. So now, doing all this, and you know, using these expressions which he calculated for R0 tilde and for R4 tilde, and plugging it here, you can get a recursion relation between RU and R tilde U tilde. And then you can write a differential equation, differential form of these things. And so we arrived at the following expression. Dr over dl equals to, so we call it a beta function. Whatever is on the right-hand side, you call it a beta function. And it's given by 2r plus u over 2. And then there was this abbreviation kd, and then r plus lambda square. And then for u, we get a du over dl, which we call beta u. And it's epsilon times u minus 3 halves u square kd r plus lambda square square. So these were the RG equations which we got from these calculations. RG equations. Okay, and so this epsilon was just 4 minus d, and kd is lambda to power d sd, and then 2 pi to power d, just an abbreviation, so that everything simplifies. Okay, so that was the step B. So in the step B, we just did this thing here, this calculated quantities, and you get these RG equations. Everybody happy so far? So finally, step C, which we will do today, is, so step C is to analyze fixed points. And infer on some physics. Okay, so that's something which you'll do today. Just a reminder. So in the first approximation, if you want the beta function, what stands here is just the classical dimension times that coupling constant here. So this is a classical dimension of R. This is a classical dimension of U. And you can always write these two terms. And then you will have some corrections depending on, you know, to how many loops you go and to how many interactions you go and so on. OK? So let's start analyzing these fixed points, unless there's a question. So what we will be really doing is we first find these fixed points, which are predicted by your RG equations. We will find that there are two of them. And then we will analyze, you know, whether they are stable or unstable, meaning whether they attract the flow of the couplings or whether they repel it. Okay, so fixed points. And of course, they are found from the fact that you want dr over dl equals to 0 and equals to du over dl equals to 0, or your beta functions are equal to 0. Okay, so solving the second one, so you see that you can have u times, and then it's epsilon, and then it's minus 3 halves u kd, and then r plus lambda square square. Okay, so what I will do is that, well, of course, one solution is u equals to 0. So you have two solutions. You have solution u equal to 0, and then u equal to this bracket equal to 0. But what I will do is I'll simplify my life, and you can justify it later, is that, of course, r, you know, is something like, it was proportional to small t. So it was something which is, you know, goes to 0 as you are at the critical temperature, okay? So that must be much smaller than your cutoff lambda, okay? So in the first approximation, you can say, well, this r, I neglect that r, and I just take this lambda to the 4, okay? And then you can solve it more easily. Okay, so one solution is u equal to 0, and then here, the other solution is, well, epsilon 2 times 2/3 epsilon and then lambda to the 4 divided by kd. That's the other solution. And so now if you look at the other equation, so if u is equal to 0 and you are setting this guy equal to 0, then of course r must be equal to 0. So r equals to 0. And here, the second solution, again, I'll neglect this r in the denominator. And so you have that r is u over 4, u over 4, and then kd, and then lambda square. And of course, you have to plug this u here. So in the end, what you find is that this is, well, let's see if it is 2/3 lambda kd epsilon. And so kd gets killed, and then lambda square is in the denominator, so it should be epsilon over 6 lambda square. Is it? It's not. What happened? 2/3 epsilon lambda 4 kd. Oh, there's a minus sign here. So it's for that. And now it's almost this. Okay, so that's your solution. So you have two fixed points. One of them is this guy, and the other one is that guy here. Okay, the first one is called Gaussian fixed point. Or mean field theory fixed point. And the second one you discovered is called Wilson-Fisher. It was probably discovered by these two gentlemen. Fisher, and they got a Nobel Prize for that. So yeah, doing a Nobel Prize calculation, diagonalizing, as we shall see, diagonalizing 2x2 matrix. So that's what the Nobel Prize is for, basically. Okay? So these are two possible fixed points, and so now we want to, you know, analyze what happens in the vicinity of these fixed points.
How I make consistent, like, the fact that to get u, I kind of use that I drop r,
yeah.
Or is it because I drop something that goes like lambda square, against something that goes like yeah. lambda to 4.
That's
you
don't think it's lambda squared.
Oh. So.
Yeah, but if it's lambda
squared. So
it's the same
what you are effectively doing here is you are doing small epsilon expansion. So if you don't like whatever I'm doing here, you can really expand all your quantities in small epsilon. And so, you know, expand them into, you know, leading orders in epsilon. And so you treat epsilon, which is 4 minus d, as a small quantity. Okay. Of course, it's a crazy idea because, you know, it's not very small, it's 1 and bigger. But unless you are in 4 dimensions. But yeah, so we, this is basically, yeah, it's an epsilon expansion. And so, okay. Yeah. So that can just justify this thing here. But you're right, maybe it's strange that I neglected that R. And, yeah. So anyway, so let's use these. We'll be doing, you know, basically qualitative statements anyway, not really quantitative. So let's first discuss the Gaussian point. So the Gaussian one. And so what you want to do is that you basically want to, so you have your critical point at 0, 0. And then you want to linearize your RG equations in this vicinity of this critical point to find, you know, what the flow is, you know, how really the couplings behave in the vicinity of this critical point. So linearize RG equations around this point. Okay, and so what you do is that you say, well, I introduce my delta R, which will be R minus this R star minus 0, so the value of R where my critical point is. And the same way, delta U is U minus U star. In our case, it's just R and U because U star and R star equal to 0. But let's be slightly more general. And so then you do the Taylor expansion of those things there. And so if you do the Taylor expansion, of course, the first term is that you evaluate your, so you have dr over dl equals to beta of r, which you say is beta of r at r star and u star, and then plus the first correction, which will be derivative of beta times delta r. Yeah?
Yeah, so another little question. You said there that epsilon is 1 or bigger.
Okay, yeah, sure. It can be small.
No. The question I want to ask is, like, is it ever bigger? Are you actually going to use that to, like, look at the 2D Ising model? Does it give anywhere near decent predictions for the 2D?
It gives some predictions for 2D Ising model, yes.
Are they decent?
Yeah. Which are probably not completely off, but for 3D, slightly better, I think. Yeah, but you can say something about 2D Ising model.
In fact, you cannot say much.
Sorry, what was that?
In fact, you cannot say much.
Yeah, you cannot say much, but you can say something.
Because in 2D, all terms, all couplings in lambda expansion will be right.
So then you do the Taylor expansion. And you can write it as a matrix. So you'll have d over dl, and then delta r, and delta u. And of course, it's given by the matrix, which where you. And the first term of the Taylor expansion is where. So because beta at r star and u star is equal to 0, then the first term is the derivative of beta. So what you are getting here is data d over d beta r over r, and then d beta r du, and then the same thing for u, so d beta u over dr, and d beta u over du, and you evaluate that at r equal to r star, and u equal to u star, and then delta r delta u. Okay, so this is just the Taylor expansion which you are doing around the critical point in general. Okay, so now of course our R star and U star are just equal to zero, and you can calculate what these quantities are in the matrix and then evaluate them at R equal to zero. So for example, dBr over dr, well, neglecting the second term, well, the r in the denominator of the second term, you just get 2. Okay, so this is some matrix, which I'll call M. This matrix is M, but you can calculate what this matrix is explicitly. And so dBr over dr, neglecting this guy here, and so you just get 2. So 2. And so dBr over the U, well, is just kd over 2. Kd over 2 lambda square. dBu over the R, well, beta U doesn't depend on R, so it's 0. And d beta U over the U, and okay, and then you plug U equal to 0, so only the first term contributes, and it gives you epsilon. Okay, so this is your matrix M for our Gaussian fixed point. Of course, the thing you learn in your linear algebra course is whenever you have a matrix, you're trying to find its eigenvalues and eigenvectors, right? So let's do it. Okay, so now you want eigenvalues, of course they are given by determinant of M minus lambda times unit matrix equals to 0, and that gives you your eigenvalue lambda, and then eigenvectors. They are simply such vectors which satisfy that M minus lambda 1 times V equals to 0. So you're interested in these vectors V, so that this is true for the corresponding lambda. So I find lambda here, and then I plug it here, and then I find the corresponding V lambda there. Okay, V lambda. Okay, so let's do it. So now, because your matrix has, you know, a quasi-diagonal form, basically what you see on the diagonal are already the eigenvalues. So you have 2 eigenvalues, 2 and epsilon. Okay. So. You have 2 eigenvalues, lambda 1 and lambda 2. So let me call them, well, for some stupid reason, lambda t and lambda u tilde. And so the first eigenvalue is just equal to 2, and the second eigenvalue is just equal to epsilon. Okay? So which you can directly see from that matrix. And then you want the corresponding eigenvectors. And so that means I really have to have, I have to write down what M minus the corresponding lambda times unit matrix is, and solve that for V lambda. And so, you know, sometimes people are interested in normalized eigenvectors. Well, it's not really important here. So let's just, you know, get a direction, which is the right direction here. And so solving that, you would find that the eigenvector corresponding to t is just 1, 0. And you can check that yourself. And then the eigenvector corresponding to u tilde is given by 1, and then there's 2 times epsilon minus 2 lambda square kd. So that's one such eigenvector. It's not normalized, it's just, you know, one solution of that equation. Okay, so now, so why I introduced these t and u tilde directions is basically, so you have your space of couplings R and U. Okay, and then you have a fixed point somewhere there. And so what these directions, these eigenvectors really tell you is, you know, in which directions your matrix is normalized. So in which directions your RG equations look like diagonal RG equations. So then, you know, in these directions, in T and U tilde, you get your RG equations are just diagonal equations. Okay, and so you get lambda T times T, and then the U tilde over DL is just lambda U tilde times U tilde. So you have chosen these new directions, T and U, which are, of course, along this guy and along that guy, so that you diagonalize your RG equations. Okay, and this must be true. So of course, if this is true, you can solve these RG equations now, because this is, you know, the solution is just an exponential. So T is some T0 exponential on lambda T times T. And similarly, U tilde is U tilde 0 E lambda U tilde. L is my parameter, and L. Okay, so we diagonalize these things, but of course we know what lambda T and lambda U are. So this is just T0 E to 2L, and this is U0 E to epsilon L. Okay, so now it's, you know, it's interesting to consider two cases, the case whether the epsilon is bigger than zero or smaller than zero. Okay, so let me start with the case when epsilon is smaller than zero. Epsilon is smaller than zero. That means because epsilon is 4 minus d, that d is bigger than 4. Okay, so this is the first case. So now this is my space of couplings U and R. So this is U, this is R. I am discussing a fixed point, the Gaussian fixed point, which is at U equal to 0 and R equal to 0. So this is my fixed point. And it's the Gaussian one. Okay. And then you have these special directions given by vt and vu tilde, along which something happens. So this vt is just 1, 0. So it just really gives me this type of direction. And vu tilde, well, epsilon is smaller than 0. So this is 1, and this is something negative. So I'm going 1 here, but now I'm going negative here. So that the corresponding direction is actually something like this. OK. And so the statement is, if you are, for example, going along this U tilde direction and epsilon is smaller than 0, then as L increases, then you have E to minus something negative and, you know, increasing. So as the time flows, L goes bigger and bigger, you are getting closer and closer to that Gaussian fixed point, right? So U tilde goes to 0. That means there's a direction like this, and there's a direction like that. On the other hand, if, no matter what epsilon is, this guy is always positive. So that means as L increases, I'm flowing away from the Gaussian fixed point. So actually, along this direction, you have something like this. OK, so you can now plot some kind of trajectories. Of course, this is only sort of true, you know, in the vicinity of this G. But anyway, so you would have something like trajectories like this, and you would have trajectories like that, and you would have trajectories like that, and then trajectories like that along this Gaussian, around this Gaussian fixed point. Okay, so what does it mean? Is that, well, there's one thing which I didn't tell you, So remember when we were constructing this Landau-Ginzburg functional, there was a condition that the coupling constant U has to be positive, right? So if it were negative, you would have actually global minimum somewhere for U goes to infinity, and it was unstable on physical situation. So you had to have U positive. So what it means is actually that this half of the diagram where U is negative is unphysical. And so really interesting thing is happening for U bigger than zero. So now you see that you have things which flow away from the Gaussian fixed point, but also things which flow inside the Gaussian fixed point. So now the direction R, if you remember, is proportional to T. So it tells you something about the critical temperature, right? And so the fact that if you move along this R direction, and so if you are exactly R equal to zero, then you stay at that Gaussian fixed point means if I am exactly at the critical temperature, I stay at the critical temperature. If I am slightly away from the critical temperature, I flow away. Well, so I cannot be in the, you know, I cannot have a phase transition. That's fine. Phase transition doesn't happen, for temperatures which are not T critical. Okay, so you're always, so R direction is always unstable. Always unstable. Because the phase transition can happen only if you are at the critical temperature. So you have always one unstable direction, which will be the R direction is always unstable. So about the stability of the fixed point, it decides the other direction. In our case, this U tilde direction. And in our case, this goes inside a fixed point. So U tilde direction, you know, is stable one, is stable. And if you have one stable direction here, then you say that Gaussian fixed point is actually stable. So G is stable. So there is one direction how actually you are attracted to this Gaussian fixed point.
So R isn't stable,
but U is stable. So yeah, you know, if I move here, I'm attracted to G.
Okay.
So if you go away, you are unstable. If you go inside, you are stable.
So
basically, R is unstable means that the phase transition happens only at the critical temperature, which is fine, right? So if you are away from the critical temperature, the phase transition doesn't happen. Okay, so from there, you infer that this R direction is always unstable. You always flow away from the phase transition, flow away from the critical point if you don't start at the critical temperature. Okay. Whereas this one, you know, is so this direction actually tries to, if you deviate from the Gaussian fixed point, it tries to put you back. Right? So if I am somewhere on the line, I will eventually flow to my Gaussian fixed point. So I will eventually flow to the phase transition. Okay? So that's why you call that direction stable. So you know, it's just the terminology. If you go inside, it's stable. If you go outside, it's unstable. Okay? So this is what happens for D bigger than 4. And so notice that this, why is this fixed point called Gaussian or mean field theory critical fixed point, is that it happens exactly at R equal to 0. So R equal to 0 was, or T equal to 0 was precise, and so T is T minus TC over TC. So really, the fixed point occurs at T critical as predicted by mean field theory. Okay, so that means T critical is as predicted by mean field theory. Okay, so that's why people call this guy a mean field theory critical point, because it happens exactly at the temperature as predicted by mean field theory, and it's stable. So you know, there will be a phase transition at this point exactly, and so that's a good point. Okay, so now.
David.
Yes.
Can you remind me what
what like physical parameters in that Heisman model are in U, in the parameter U?
In parameter U, what was that? Yeah, I can go to your note where this was derived, in some sense. What was that?
Is it like J or B or?
It's something which, you know, has to be positive. U has to be positive for your stability. But, you know, if you look at your derivation of the continuum limit, you would find what the parameters are hiding in U. It's, yeah.
Okay. So, is it just that R is the unstable direction because there's a phase transition when you sweep that parameter, and then there's no phase transition when you sweep the parameter U, or whatever those correspond to physically, or that corresponds to physically, something?
Yeah, so you can think about, you know, is it possible to get to my fixed point at all or not? Okay, so if both directions, okay, so let me just, you know, do this thing. The epsilon is now bigger than zero, meaning D is smaller than four. So maybe let's just answer your question. So if epsilon is bigger than zero, then this guy repels, and that guy repels as well. So your Gaussian fixed point now looks like this thing here. So you have U, and you have R, and you're flowing away in this direction, but you're also flowing away in that direction. So in some sense, there is no way you can get into that fixed point if you start out of it. If you start exactly in it, of course you stay there. But if you start out of it, there's no way you can fly, you know, you can flow inside that. So there's no way you can actually reach it. There's no way you can reach the phase transition. Okay, so this is unstable, and, you know, cannot be reached if you want. Cannot be reached.
So the point is that in order to get a phase transition, you need to tune the temperature yourself from outside.
I
have a system, and I
that's right. Yeah. Well, that's right. The phase transition happens exactly only at T critical. If you are outside of that, there's no way. Yeah. Yeah.
But it does happen, right? Like, I mean, if water would be described by that, and I put it in a microwave, it's still going to like vaporize. It's just not going to do that spontaneously.
This flow is not talking about if you just like put a system and leave it, the system will like somehow change and not describe it as. That's not what it's talking about. It's talking about if you like rescale and look at it at larger and larger scales, does your system like go look like it's further away from critical, or does it look like it's closer to critical?
Yeah.
We can talk about that.
Why do we do that? It seems like a strange question to ask, right? If I look at the
biggest maybe let me continue and we can discuss it later. Okay. So if you are below four dimensions, you find that this Gaussian fixed point here is unstable. So there's no way you can reach it. And so because it's precisely the fixed point predicted by the mean field theory, it's precisely happens as r equal to 0 and so on, then it tells you that the mean field theory actually will have to break down for dimensions more than 4. So it's not an exact theory. Of course, now you can consider also the case epsilon equals to 0, but you cannot tell much about this point because, it's a marginal dimension, and would have to go to higher order expansion in Landau-Ginzburg theory, say something about d equal to 4. But anyway, this is the proof that basically, you know, this fixed point is not a good one below d equal to 4. So now you can do the same thing for the Wilson-Fisher point. Wilson-Fisher point. So part B, the Wilson-Fisher one, and so. This is the value U star is equal to that, and R star is equal to that. So if I concentrate, let's say, on epsilon bigger than 0, so D is smaller than 4, if epsilon is bigger than 0, you see that the value of U is positive, and the value of R is negative. So you'll have a point something like here. So you have u, and then you have r direction, and this is your point here. Okay, so now what you actually predicted is quite interesting, is that because the value of r is now smaller than zero, so this is where your Gaussian fixed point is, this is where your Wilson-Fisher fixed point is. So now the value of r is smaller than zero. So r of Wilson-Fisher is smaller than zero. So what does it mean? So t minus t critical is smaller than zero, which means that the true critical temperature corresponding to this Wilson-Fisher point is actually lower than the t critical predicted by Gaussian. So t critical of Wilson-Fisher is smaller than t critical of Gaussian. Okay, well, that makes sense. So we know that the mean field theory neglects fluctuations. Okay, if you start adding fluctuations into your system, ordering is more difficult. So actually, to reach the ordered phase, to reach the phase transition, you have to cool your system to lower temperatures than predicted by the mean field theory. So this is an effect of fluctuations, effect of fluctuations. So really, I have to cool my system to temperature which is lower than that predicted by mean field theory, so that I have a phase transition. So now you can do the same analysis as for the Gaussian fixed point. So you'll find that your matrix M is given by, well, you can find it in the notes, 2 minus epsilon over 3, and then kd over 2 lambda square, and then 0, and then minus epsilon. And then you can find the corresponding eigenvectors and eigenvalues. So minus epsilon over 3, that's my lambda. And then lambda u tilde is just minus epsilon. And then vt is just 1, 0. And v u tilde is 1 minus 4 thirds, 3 plus epsilon, lambda square over kd, and you can do it yourself again. So you know, just doing this math here, you see that if epsilon is bigger than zero, then let's say one, so then this guy is positive, but this guy is negative. Okay, if it's negative, it means that I'm actually flowing in. If it's positive, I'm flowing out. So again, in the t direction, I'm flowing out. But in the u direction, I'm flowing in. So if I am in epsilon bigger than 1, the picture is like that. Here, I'm flowing out. And here, I'm flowing in. At the same time, for epsilon bigger than 0, that is our picture. So you have the Gaussian fixed point going like that. And you can sort of predict some flows which go here. So you'll have something which goes like that. And then you have something that doesn't work, does it? Then you have something that goes like that, and like that. But you see that for epsilon bigger than 0 or d smaller than 4, your Wilson-Fisher point is actually an attractive, it's stable one, as the Gaussian one is not stable one. So if you are in less than 4 dimensions, this is the right fixed point to consider for your phase transition, not that one. That's why the mean field theory breaks. So that's the case for epsilon bigger than 0. And then if you go for epsilon smaller than 0, then you find that your Wilson-Fisher point actually occurs somewhere in the negative plane here for negative u. So it's not physical. So if you are for epsilon smaller than 0, Wilson-Fisher, so epsilon smaller than 0, Wilson-Fisher is unphysical. Unphysical because it happens u star is actually smaller than 0. OK, so the conclusion is, above four dimensions, the Gaussian fixed point is the only one which is relevant for us, and it's stable one. So the mean field theory is correct. If you are below four dimensions, it's the Wilson-Fisher one, which is the stable one. Gaussian one is non-stable one. And so it's the Wilson-Fisher fixed point which is interesting and important for your phase transition.
I don't understand why we're calling it stable when it's like a subtle.
Yeah, so this is a good point. So in field theory, stable is something which is always attractive. So in statistical physics, in the t-direction, it will always be unstable. So you will call a stable fixed point such that has stable directions. All other directions than the temperature direction are stable.
Okay.
So here we have just two couplings. So if we have one stable direction, we call that stable. Because in the t-direction, in the temperature direction, always unstable. If you are in field theory, yes, you can have everything stable and everything flowing in, and that's fine. But in statistical physics, you cannot have that.
The fact that T isn't stable means that if I watch my system in a temperature different from the critical temperature and I start coarse graining, what I would see at the end is one phase or the other. That's the idea.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
I'm not going to see the fractal structure. I'm not going to see the it's not going to be conformal. That's
if you are outside of that, yeah.
All right.
Yeah. Okay. Precisely. So. So what you just said. Let me just draw this picture once more. So we concluded that if you are summarized for epsilon bigger than zero or d smaller than four, the right picture to think about is precisely this one. You have the Gaussian fixed point. You have the Wilson-Fisher fixed point. This is unstable, this is unstable, this is stable. And so this guy can sort of flow in. Of course, you cannot know globally. This is unstable, this is unstable. So now if you are on this line here, anywhere on this line, you flow to the Wilson-Fisher one. So you actually are undergoing the phase transition. If you are anywhere else, so this line corresponds to phase transition. Transition in some sense. If you are anywhere else, you just flow away from that fixed point. So you go that direction and you go that direction. So now this happens for temperatures which are bigger than Tc. So here you flow to paramagnetic phase. And if you are below T critical, you flow to the ferromagnetic phase. Okay? So the line here corresponds to the phase transition, of course, at this, you flow eventually to this point here. And if you are, to the left of that line, you flow to the ferromagnetic phase. And if you are to the right of the line, you flow to the paramagnetic phase. Yes?
In an experiment, can we compare the
so in the experiment, you control usually just the temperature, right? What is?
Like the physical reading.
Of you?
No. The
of L?
You are.
Of L, the physical reading. This is like an imaginary time for your flow, or fictive time for your flow. So what it is, it governs, how much I am zooming in out of the system or zooming out of the system. That is, what would you say is the physical meaning of L? It's just, how I'm doing the post graining.
I'm drawing a flow, which is a curve.
It's so basically how much degrees of freedom you integrate out.
Yeah. So how much I'm zooming in or zooming out the system is. All right, so you can read this in notes. I think I went over this a little bit too fast, but it's just drawing basically the phase diagrams for and analyzing what happens in the vicinity of the fixed point. So now, really, I want to show you how we can use this information to calculate these critical exponents.
So how do you know that
the thing that flows out from the Gaussian explain will go into the Wilson?
You don't know. All it's like a local analysis. So you have only analysis in your local vicinity of your fixed point. So we just did the linearization. And then it's up to you, to guess, is there something which goes directly, so then you basically guess what is the global flow.
I mean, so the curve of the phase transition doesn't necessarily pass the origin, right?
It may go some weird way or something like that. It's not a straight line, it's something which you can...
But it will pass the origin.
Yeah, but eventually I think, there must be a line you can show, there must be a line which goes to that Wilson fission point. It's not a straight line, because, all your analysis basically works, your linearization works only in the vicinity of your fixed points, right? So you cannot judge on the global behavior from there. You cannot say this is precisely the direction I will follow it all the time after the Wilson fission point. You cannot say that. But you can say locally it's true, and then you can show, there will be a line which goes to that direction.
Well, I would say in this case the RG equations can be solved.
Yeah, in this case, that's right.
But in general, of course, it's
if you do linearization, then you just know the vicinity of the point. Okay, so the triumph of renormalization, we have only 20 minutes for that. So that's a pity, but maybe it's enough. So critical exponents. Hopefully a triumph. We shall see, it's not so exactly, but okay. So what we are doing? We are saying in each step, k is k times b, meaning x tilde is x over b. Meaning, and then we parameterize b as e to the l. Now, I don't require that l is necessarily small. It can be anything. OK. At the same time, we know that, phi tilde x tilde, you can do the Fourier decomposition into the momentum space. So it's d k tilde. 2 pi to power d, and then phi tilde k tilde e to k tilde and x tilde. So this is what it means, since I'm just doing the Fourier transformation in the tilde space. So now you can turn this integral to the integral over normal k, of course, using this thing here. So k tilde is now k times b. So this will give you d dk over 2 pi to power d. And then by doing the substitution, you get b to power d, just changing the measure of the integral. But we also want to change this phi tilde k tilde to phi of k. And for that, we had to use this wave function and normalization. Okay, so this is given by b to minus d plus 2 minus eta over 2 phi of k. Okay, and then we have the exponential e to I, and then you have k tilde dot x tilde, but because they exactly transfer, that they transform inversely. It's one is multiplied by b and the other one is divided by b, then it's just k times x. Okay, so now you can use this expression to write it in terms of phi of x. And so, of course, what you would like to call phi of x is this thing here. And so this factor just gets in front of that. So you get that b d minus 2 plus eta over 2 and then phi of x. So this is how phi tilde of x tilde relates to phi of x. We used everything we encountered in our renormalization procedure. We used how the wave function transforms. We used how these guys transform and so on. Okay, so that's one relation which we need. The second relation is precisely what we derived here by studying the linearized thing around the fixed point. So we know that the t tilde is given by t0. Well, before I wrote t, is t0 times the exponential of lambda t times l. So now I write t tilde as t e to lambda t times l. And then u tilde is u e to lambda u times l. Okay, so this we also derived now by this doing this normalization. Okay, so now let's use these, all these, you know, putting all these properties together, let's calculate what happens with the correlation function. Now the correlation function so before we define it as a you know sigma I sigma j minus that thing so now the average value of sigma I sigma j which is like a magnetization. So now we know that the thing which corresponds to the magnetization is the field phi. So really it makes sense in this setting to define it as phi x and let's say phi 0 minus phi x and then phi 0. And that corresponds to basically the definition which we had before. Okay. So now of course the correlation length depends not only on x, but it also depends on the actual value of the couplings which we have at that given instant. Okay, so we have that g x tilde, t tilde, and u tilde, well, is given by, and then using all these properties which we have here. So it's g, so x tilde is just x over b. Okay. Well, that's that. And then t tilde is just t e to lambda t times l. And u tilde is u e to lambda u times l. OK, so that's what it must be. So I use just these relations here. But at the same time, I know that g is a product of two phis. Okay, and each of the phis, if I want g tilde x tilde, so I have phi tilde here, so I have to relate it to phi through this thing here. Okay, so this must be equal to b, and you have two of them, so b times d minus 2 plus eta times g x t u. Oh, because you know that it's a product of two phis. So what I'm really calculating is like g tilde. So g of x tilde t tilde is g tilde. So now I have g tilde, I must be phi tilde, but I know how phi tilde is expressed in terms of phi. Okay, so this is definitely true. Or you can write it in the other way around, so you can express the g x t u, x t and u, it's now, there's a minus sign here. So b to minus d minus 2 plus eta and then this whatever g x over b, and then t e lambda t l, and then u e lambda u l. Okay, so this is the crucial relation, and so basically it reminds you of the scaling hypothesis, which you've seen yesterday in your tutorial. Okay, so but yeah, so it's basically the derivation of the scaling hypothesis. Of course, we derive this, yeah, okay, the derivation of the scaling hypothesis. Very good. So we know how the correlation function changes under the RG flow, under the flow of the couplings. Okay. So now, how to extract these from here, the critical exponents. So let's use this transformation property for special values of x, t, and u. Okay. So the first thing will be start exactly at critical point at t and u equals to 0 and 0. Okay, so then using this thing, I have g of x 0 and 0 is equal to b minus t plus 2 minus 2 plus eta. And then g of x over b, but because t is 0 and u is 0, so are the exponentials, so 0, 0. Okay, I'm just plugging 0, 0 there for t is 0 and u 0. Okay, so if you do that, so now you look at this thing. So you have a function of x is multiplication something of function of x over b. So now you may start thinking about, you know, what kind of function this must be. And you find that this function must be 1 over x to that power. So from here, you conclude that gx 0, 0 is actually proportional to 1 over x to d minus 2 plus eta. So that's the only function which satisfies this property here. Okay. Aha. Uh-huh. So now, of course, you have seen this. And so you know that your correlation length, the correlation function, has to behave like exponential, but there is also this x to d minus 2 plus eta. Right? So the eta before, we called our anomalous dimension, and it was a critical exponent. And you can connect that eta with our eta, which was just definition of r2 tilde, what it was. So this eta is really an anomalous dimension as a critical exponent. So really, it wasn't a fault to call that eta in the renormalization procedure the same number, you know, the same letter, because it is really the anomalous dimension which we define as a critical exponent before. Okay, so yeah, so we identified one critical exponent. But remember that in our procedures we were deriving, you know, what these things were. So taking all into account all the diagrams which we did, we found that eta actually was equal to 0, right? So we didn't find any eta correction to that. And so the prediction to our order of approximation of the unionormalization group is that this eta must be equal to 0. Okay, so that's our first critical exponent. Okay, so the next thing which we would like to calculate is the correlation length critical exponent, so nu. So how do you do that? is that you now move away from the critical point in the t direction, in t direction. Okay, that means I consider still u equal to 0, but t is not equal to 0 now. So I have g x t and 0 is equal to b minus, well, d minus 2 plus eta, which is 0 anyway, d minus 2 plus eta, and then g x over b, and then t e lambda t l and 0. So that's what our expression now becomes. And so now there's a trick thing to do here. So this thing is valid for any L. That means it's valid for any B in some sense. This is true for any B. Okay. So in particular, I can choose B equal to X. So that's a sneaky idea. So let's choose B equal to X. Okay. So then we have G X T 0 equals to X minus T minus 2 plus eta. And then G, and then X over B is 1. And then you have E to the L times lambda T and 0. But E to the L is B. Okay, so this is X to lambda T. And then I'm missing t there. Sorry for that. It's t times, so t x lambda t. Okay, so this is what it is. So now, of course, this thing here is what we already guessed here. So it's this 1 over x d minus 2 plus eta. So that's fine. So the rest thing must be actually some function. So this thing here must be some function of x divided by the correlation length, so that we have the connection with what we had before. So we know that the g looks like 1 over this thing here times exponential of x over xi. So I don't even require here that it's an exponential, it's some function of x over xi. Okay, so in other words, you have to have, but of course this is just g of t of x to lambda t. So if you can write t times x to lambda t must be a function of x over xi, right? Because it has to be. So for that, you write it as t to 1 over lambda t times x to lambda t. Well, I haven't done anything, so that's fine. Okay, and then you write this as x over xi to lambda t. And so you identify that this xi is actually proportional to t minus 1 over lambda t. Okay, so this is what I have. This is a trivial identity, and this is what I require. And so I have to identify that xi is t to minus 1 over lambda t, okay?
Why do we require that?
Sorry?
Why do we require that?
Oh, so you want to make a connection with the fact that g goes like 1 over x to d minus 2 plus eta, but what we had also was the exponential of xi, of x over xi, right? So I'm saying, well, I already see this guy here is here. Right, so now I want that whatever stands here is a function of x over xi, right? I don't even require it as an exponential, but this will be a function of x over xi if this thing is x over xi, right? Because that's the only argument of g here. So this is, you know, this is equal to g 1 t x lambda t and 0. And then this thing here. Yeah. But so this thing must be function of x over xi.
Yeah, but why can't it be like x over xi to the square to the lambda t?
X over xi to, it can be square. Well, you can do any powers, yes.
Oh, okay.
But it will be the same result.
This functional form of g, is it an additional assumption we make? Or
No. It just comes from here, right? Well, or, you know, this one here.
Yeah.
Yeah, this one here is you're looking, yeah. You have to make connection with whatever you have done in your normalization group with whatever you know it must be. Right? So in order to, you know, so this thing, you know, in order to identify the critical exponent mu, you know that it describes how this correlation length behaves in the critical point. So you really have to impose this thing here to make identification with the critical exponents which we defined before.
You kind of need it to be an exponential, though. Otherwise, you need it to be an exponential, though, if you want to recover that form.
Yeah, sure. You need it to be exponential. But it's fine. I'm saying this must be true, whether it's exponential or not. At this point, it's okay. Okay, so now you define this to be t to minus nu, right? So you require that your correlation length goes with t to minus nu, where nu is your critical exponent. And hence, your prediction is nu is just this small eigenvalue with respect to this time thing. So it's 1 over lambda t, okay? So now, of course, if you're interested in d smaller than 4, then this lambda t is the lambda t of my Wilson-Fisher fixed point. So it's this lambda t here, right? So this is equal to 1 over, and then it's 2 minus epsilon over 3. And treating epsilon as small, this is 1/2, and then plus epsilon over 12. Okay, so that's your prediction for the critical exponent nu for your Ising model. So now we can take really numerical simulations for your Ising model, and what you find is that so you take d equal to 3 Ising. And the critical exponent nu is predicted to be nu is 0.63. That's a numerical prediction. So that's numerics. And so if you take epsilon equal to 1 and calculate this guy, so nu in our randomization group thing, you'll find it's 0.58. So it's not exactly true, but it's almost true. Okay, so really you can so this randomization group gives you something which is, you know, in the right ballpark. It's definitely better than mean field theory. In the mean field theory, you had 0.5. So this is halfway better than the mean field theory. Okay, you're halfway there. Okay, so now I'm running out of time, so that's fine. So you will calculate all the critical exponents in your tutorial today from this thing. But basically, the idea is really to use these, you know, define what your correlation function is, find how it scales using all the properties of the renormalization group, and then you'll find the corresponding critical exponents. And you will do it in your today's tutorial. So let me just conclude. So, you know, this randomization group, at least for the Ising model in three dimensions, it gives you a systematic way how you can get better and better close to the actually observed critical points if you go through this thing here. Yeah?
You see, you can get better and better, but like, you see how long the calculation was to do it the second order.
Exactly, I told you, right? So if you want to get slightly better, you spend more and more time.
Yes,
right?
Yes. But so that's like an exponential process. So
yeah, of course.
How far did people actually go?
I don't know. Maybe Dennis knows, but
how far people go in epsilon expansion?
Yeah.
Yeah. How many orders did people do this?
For this theory, I put up to third order for this universality class.
Ah, so that's your project. You can go to fourth order. So there's this guy who spent 20 years calculating to the second order, and then he started the third order.
The point is that series and epsilon expansion is in fact asymptotic. So when you go to higher orders, coefficients grow before epsilon squared than epsilon cubed.
Yeah.
So if you extrapolate epsilon...
You can't go too far, but you can calculate what the ideal order is to stop, right?
It's not clear.
People have methods to estimate what would be the best result, no?
So that's why people limit themselves to the first or the second order also.
Okay, so you will see in today's tutorial how to calculate all the other critical exponents.